Welcome to CHMA Talks. I'm Erica Butler. Today we're talking about rape culture.
We dehumanize them, we objectify them, we focus on the way they look as their only value, and then we wonder why people treat them as though they're objects.
Tonight on CHMA Talks, we tackle a heavy topic with the help of Mount Allison psychology professor and sex researcher, Lisa Dawn Hamilton. Hamilton talks us through what rape culture is and how it often starts in something as simple as how different genders are represented in traditional and popular culture. She talks about the dehumanizing effect of objectification, how we socialize and raise our children, and the impact that that has on rape culture. Here's my conversation with Lisa Dawn Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you are no stranger to the airwaves. You have two podcasts that are airing on CHMA. For those who haven't caught you yet on air, can you tell us a bit about those projects?
Sure. So my main podcast project is called Do We Know Things? And it's an exploration of the things we think we know about sex. So I started it given that I'm a sex educator and a sex researcher, and I was realizing even things I thought were true were not actually true once I looked into them. And so I wanted to start a podcast talking about all the things maybe we believe about sex that aren't correct. And so that's what Do We Know Things does. And then last semester, I did a podcast project with a class of mine. So it was a small class of 17 students, and the focus was on stress, burnout, and resilience. And each student chose a topic related to stress, burnout, and resilience, and created a podcast episode to share information about that, their topic area. So there were things like, the positives of stress, to trauma, to how to build resilience from stress by using writing or creative expression. So it was a wide range of topics related to stress, burnout, and resilience. And that podcast is called This Is Fine, a podcast about stress, burnout, and resilience.
Oh, awesome. So lots of different contributors and voices in that.
Yes.
Now, the main thing I wanted to talk to you about today is sort of a heavy topic. And, you know, relates to the work you do as a sex researcher. Back in November, the Mount Allison campus erupted in protests about how the school was handling sexual assaults on campus. And you spoke at the sort of big protest that happened in front of the student center. And I recall you talked about the problem of sexual assault on campus as part of something bigger, part of a kind of larger problem of rape culture in society in general. And I found that really interesting at the time, and I've been wanting to talk to you ever since then. Let's talk about rape culture. And first, I wonder if we can just kind of define the term. Like, what does that term refer to?
Now, that is a great question and not one that is easy to answer. But broadly, it refers to a culture which demeans and devalues women primarily and sees them as objects and sees rape as a normal part of men's entitlement to women's bodies, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Now, like, I sometimes think, because there's, you know, you come across this when you talk about issues, other really heavy issues like racism, where, rape culture, the word rape itself, most people, it's abhorrent. They have an immediate, like, guttural reaction. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say even some rapists, like, would have that reaction, mm-hmm. you know? Like, mm-hmm. so it is this violence, but it's also mm-hmm. sort of pervasive, right? Like, I mean, it's around, like, this kind of rape culture is around us in more subtle ways. Is that right? Or what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I also want to give the caveat. When I talk about rape culture, I am talking about it in terms of gendered norms, so men and women. But of course, anyone can be sexually assaulted. But the dominant cultural framing of sexuality does frame rape culture as men or masculine people who are taking advantage of the bodies of women or feminine people. But again, anyone can be assaulted.
Of course, it can go the other way. This isn't 100% mm-hmm. situation. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So to answer the question, though, of the how rape culture is sort of embedded and where we see it in more subtle ways is in virtually all the media that we consume, like all fictional media, all documentaries. So there's this idea that culturally, men are supposed to ask for sex, men are supposed to want sex, and women are supposed to be the gatekeepers, and they're supposed to say no. And the premise of virtually every romantic comedy is man approaches woman says no, man spends the entire rest of the movie pursuing her until she finally says yes. So that right there is rape culture, where someone is not respecting someone's no and not respecting someone's choices and seeing the no as, oh, this just means you need to try harder. And that's kind of the big picture issue. But this happens in smaller interactions between individuals all the time, where women, for example, will say no to sex, and the man who's trying to have sex with them sees it as just meaning that, oh, they're just being shy, or they're just doing what they're supposed to do because women are supposed to say no. Now my job is to try to convince this person. But that's coercion. And we don't talk enough about it. We talk about no means no, but we don't talk about what it actually looks like in day-to-day reality and when people are actually engaging in sexual behavior. Because often it doesn't look just like a no. It looks like a, oh, I'm really tired, or, oh, I need to go meet up with my friends. And so I think there needs to be more discussion around, if there's not an enthusiastic yes, that means to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got to say, I'm currently a parent of a young child, 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. So always mm-hmm. my brain goes to like my dealings with this child and what I have to try and teach him about consent, which is mm-hmm. often quite like, it's more challenging than I would have thought, because, you know, mm-hmm. we know sort of, well, consent can be, it should be straightforward, right? Yes means yes. Mm-hmm. But it does, it gets hard to interpret. It gets, I don't know. And also surprisingly difficult for a human being to learn, I'm finding out. You can't just sort of say, here's what it means. And then this kid who is, I guess, developing will automatically know. It's a real process that happens over time, that they have to, that respect of another being and their space and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But that's just me sort of, you know, sinking into my own experience here. This issue around consent and how it happens. And I suppose how, the difference between like, is there a possibility for things like, wooing someone, or like we have these terminologies, these sort of romantic terminologies around like pursuit of someone, but mm-hmm. does that mm-hmm. is that really all just a mirage, and it's all really coercion, or is there any sort of valid version of that?
That is a great question. I actually want to go back to your point about teaching kids about consent.
Oh, sure.
And before I get to this, if that's
yeah.
okay. And so I teach sex ed to parents to how to talk to their kids about sex ed through my organization, Sex Ed East. And we cover consent in our classes for parents of teens and tweens, as well as parents of younger kids. And I always say that it needs to start really early on, both respecting the bodily autonomy and the consent of your own child, and teaching them to respect that bodily autonomy and consent of other people. Because we see this all the time, where parents are teaching kids to not value their instincts and go against their instincts. So for example, if, you know, grandma wants a hug and the kid says no, parents are often like, don't be rude, go hug your grandma. So that there tells them that their consent is less important than not, or their, and what they desire is less important than not being rude, and that the priority is to not be rude. And this is especially harmful for people being raised as girls because they're the ones who later on are consistently taught throughout their life to appease others. And so having that message, you know, from a very young age can really get ingrained in their psyche. But it's important for all kids to teach them that they're allowed to say yes and no about what they want to happen to their body. And if it's something that has to happen, say a shot at the doctor's office, then explaining very clearly why that has to happen. And so I think starting that conversation really early helps people learn about, they get to have a say in who touches their body and that that's okay and that they can trust their gut. If they feel like, I don't want to hug grandma or I don't want Uncle Bobby to be tickling me, that they can say no and that will be respected. So I think that's a big piece of starting consent early. And then also talking about it from an early age and talking about other people's feelings. Because we often, and this is related to pursuit as well, we represent women in movies and television as more two-dimensional. And so we see them as objects to be pursued for male pleasure. And we don't see people, and so we're not exposed, especially kids are not exposed to media that depicts women and girls or anyone who's different than them. If they're white, straight males, there's not good representation of the inner workings and the emotional experience of those people, or people who are different than straight white males. And so
basically like anyone who's different becomes sort of the object or like a very flat, like you said, two-dimensional sort of version of a human that doesn't really have the same nuance as you give yourself or your group, you know? Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. You're listening to CHMA Talks on 106.9 FM in Sackville. I'm Erica Butler. Today we're talking with Lisa Dawn Hamilton, Mount Allison's sex researcher and producer of the Do We Know Things podcast. Before the break, I had asked Dr. Hamilton about the question of pursuit and how the practice of wooing fits into our understanding of rape culture today. Here's Dr. Lisa Dawn Hamilton.
I do think I put high value on being very clear about your intentions to pursue someone. And if it's just pursuing or wooing to get a date, like flirting, I think it's pretty obvious to someone when someone else is flirting back. And if that's not obvious, then I think that someone needs to perhaps figure out how to better understand interacting with other people. But I think pursuit is fun and it's part of sexuality, but it also is usually, it goes both ways. So even if one person is maybe less enthusiastic than the other or pursuing, not the one pursuing, there is a dynamic of flirtation that's happening. But if you're pursuing someone and they're just like, no, I'm not interested, or they're avoiding your calls or they're not responding to your texts, I think that's not necessarily pursuit. That's non-consensual harassment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, yeah, it's interesting. Like, so many of these, like when you do break it down, you get to the clear answer of like, yeah, that there's a line that got crossed and there's where it got crossed. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, an interesting thing. And when I talk about, you know, talking to my kid about consent, mm-hmm. I mean, he's nine. So obviously we're not really, well, maybe I should be, I'm revealing myself for the inadequate parent that I am, but we haven't really talked about sex except in a very sort of passing way of responding to any questions he might have so far. So it's not really, when we talk about consent, we're not talking necessarily, but like you said, you're really talking about power over yourself and your body and that sort of thing. You're kind of teaching that kind of respect of others' bodies and respect for your own and like keeping those boundaries. And it's interesting that I mean, to me, that, I mean, a lot of our issues seem to also come from just this inability to really understand social interactions very well. And I'm wondering, like, why do we have such a problem with this in our world? Like, why do so many people's wires get crossed about communicating on these issues?
I think part of it is the cultural expectations of how it's supposed to look, for one thing,
Right.
related to what I was saying before, that, one sex is supposed to pursue the other sex, and that harassment is deemed as normal in the media that we consume. But there's also entitlement. Boys are often socialized and raised to be entitled to take what they want, whereas girls are socialized more likely to defer to others and, not trust their gut and not be rude. And it's important to be polite and ladylike. And even if we don't explicitly say those things anymore, although I saw it in a restaurant pre-COVID, someone chastised their daughter for something because it wasn't ladylike, which I thought was very bizarre in this day and age. But we socialize girls to be nice and to constantly worry about other people's feelings. And we don't give that same sort of empathy education to boys. We don't tell them to think about the feelings of the person that they're punching, for example, or that's less likely to happen with boys. And the research shows that girls are more constantly monitored in their social interactions than boys as they're being raised. And that's another thing that I teach about, is teaching your kids about empathy. So pointing out other people's feelings, getting them to recognize how another person might feel. Because I think what often happens in situations, if we're talking about men and women, is men are not aware of what's going on emotionally for that woman because they've never had to think about the feelings of women and girls growing up. And so the woman thinks that she's very clearly conveying, like, I'm not interested, please leave me alone. And the men are not picking that up because they haven't been taught that what the signals are that mean no if someone's not explicitly saying no. And also, even when people do explicitly say no, that's taken as an invitation to try harder.
And so much of this, like, training, like the sort of, our education in becoming empathetic, like how we learn to be that. It's interesting to me that, like, it's not just, this is not really just straight parent to child, like on forever. There's like really powerful things that you don't have any control over as a parent that are just out there in the world that have existed and persist for a long time. Like that's probably in a way where we get sort of most of our, like, I just think back to the TV shows I watched as a kid and those role models that I watched, and that's probably more how I learned to either be empathetic or not in a given situation or even make the effort, even more so than maybe what my parents were telling me or reminding me, that kind of thing. I guess they both play a role.
And the objectification of women in media is something that's been studied for decades. And when we objectify people, so reduce them to two-dimensional or even one-dimensional things in our media, and that is, again, mainstream media, but also pornography. Women are presented as objects for male pleasure. And in war, for example, the first thing to do is to dehumanize the enemy, so that they are objectified, and so people can feel more comfortable killing in war. So these are tactics that are used intentionally in fields of things like war that are then applied to how we represent women in media. And we dehumanize them, we objectify them, we focus on the way they look as their only value, and then we wonder why people treat them as though they're objects.
You're listening to CHMA Talks on 106.9 FM in Sackville. I'm Erica Butler in conversation with Dr. Lisa Dawn Hamilton about rape culture. We've touched on what it is, where it comes from. Next, we turn to what we can do about it. The more we talk about it, the more sort of depressing it gets. So, like, I'm thinking, I wonder, like, is there, can we talk a bit about ways that people are trying to turn it around? What are sort of the practices and the efforts that people are, ways of looking at things? I guess, you know, the parent, like you helping parents sort of work with kids and teach kids it about consent in a really positive, constructive way. That seems like one sort of solution moving forward. Is there other things that we can, you know, our communities and our families can be doing?
Well, feminists have been trying to solve this problem for probably over a century, maybe longer.
Yeah.
But from my knowledge of feminist history, of say starting in the late 1800s, and it really is part of the culture of male dominance. So when we live in a society where laws are created by men to protect men, all of our governments are run by predominantly men, it needs to be an entirely societal shift to not have a male dominant perspective. And one example can be things like marital rape laws. So it wasn't until 1983 in Canada that it became illegal to rape your wife, because before that, it was seen as the wife's duty was to have, like, a man or a husband could not rape his wife because that is her duty, was to essentially be his sex slave. Mm-hmm. And it took till 1983 before that was deemed illegal in Canada. And so laws like that that have been in existence for centuries, that only very recently have been changed. So I would say a lot of the changes do need to come at a social level. So pushing back on laws and structures that are created by and for men. So that's kind of the big meta level. And then from the kind of ground up level, I think just individuals paying more attention to the power structures in their lives, and how they interact with people of different genders or sexual orientations, and as well as the media they consume. I do agree with you that I think media has a large effect on how we perceive people. And if we don't see ourselves represented in thoughtful, fleshed out ways in, say, fictional media, it's harder to convince others to see you in fleshed out, three-dimensional ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I think about the problem with male dominance, like pervading society on all these different levels, like from legal right down to like family relations, it's on the one hand, it seems like, well, you need to flip it, or, you know, get the male out of the dominance. But really the problem is actually the dominance, isn't it? It's the how we want everything to be sort of a hierarchical mm-hmm. sort of power structure where someone controls someone else. it almost seems to be how we imagine the world, and like we can't even barely imagine it without someone being controlled.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And feminists in leadership, or not leadership, but feminist organizations for a long time have pushed back against the hierarchical model of organizing and gone towards consensus-based decision-making or collective-based decision-making, where everybody is included at all levels and everyone has essentially an equal voice, or at least the organization strives to give everyone an equal voice. In any organization, though, it is, or any structure, it's really difficult to avoid a hierarchy in some senses. So because I think we do often default to that because that's what we're used to. So it does take a lot of work to actively, you know, push back against power structures and and work on a more collective and egalitarian based model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a real, it's a tall order, but a worthy one. Like it's, yeah, interesting. I wanted to also talk a bit about your work that you're doing right now as part of the working group on sexual violence prevention at Mount Allison. I don't know if we can take that turn, but I'm, you know, I'm curious to know as the co-chair of that group, how you feel the process is going so far. You know, how is it going?
Well, we have a really great group. I think as part of the working group, there are 11 of us, both staff and students working together. And we've had a number of meetings where we've been hashing out what we think are the different issues that need to be addressed to improve things on the Mount Allison campus. And overall, I'm happy with the discussions we've had. But even as we're having these discussions, we're realizing, like, even things I thought were pretty straightforward are feeling more complicated. And so we're having long discussions about the best ways to move forward, which I think have been quite fruitful.
I guess, I mean, can you give us a glimpse of what some of those complexities might be that you thought were going to be simple in the beginning?
Sure. So even in terms of the role of someone on campus who deals with sexual violence, what is that person's role? So going in, my first thing from day one when things started erupting is I said, whoever is responsible for supporting survivors cannot be involved in, say, investigations of what happened. And like those two things cannot overlap. And that is still very clear.
Right.
But in terms of how we support survivors, and then also what the role of the university is versus should we involve external organizations or like, yeah, even just figuring out what the role is of someone who is a survivor supporter. Is that person a crisis response person? Is that person a coordinator that helps facilitate people who can help with crisis? Yeah, there's just so many complexities in those discussions.
Right. Like just, yeah, the nitty gritty of how it actually gets delivered once it's down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, so that's good to hear that that separation will happen between the person supporting the person who reported a sexual assault versus the person who is going to sort of help adjudicate whether what happened. Yeah. You're listening to CHMA Talks on 106.9 FM in Sackville. I'm Erica Butler in conversation with Dr. Lisa Dawn Hamilton, a Mount Allison psychology professor and researcher and co-chair of the university's recently struck task force on sexual violence. As far as you know, like the group that has been chosen to do the review, so this independent review that's happening, do you have, you know, are you confident that that group is sort of qualified and, you know, is that a good choice that Manet has made there?
Yes, absolutely. So there are a feminist legal consortium and there's the consortium themselves, and then they bring in other experts have expertise in specific cases or specific organizations that they're working with. And I've met with the team that will be doing the Mount Allison review, and they seem great and they understand the issues, and they all have legal backgrounds, but they also all are very, trauma-informed, survivor-focused, and I think they will be an excellent resource for making recommendations on campus.
Awesome. So does it still seem like we are on track to possibly have, you know, a policy that might be a model for other schools?
Yes, that is my hope, both from a policy level, but also a procedural level. I would love to see Mount Allison do really groundbreaking work on education around sexual violence, for example, and shifting the narrative to be more focused on the realities of what happens in sexual interactions or in non-consensual interactions, because I think a lot of schools And it's very challenging to deal with this at a university level. I'm certainly not going to pretend it's easy, but I also think a lot of schools really focus on it on a surface level. So just, doing basic consent education, like no means no, yes means yes, but not talking about the dynamics that happen in the moment and what it might actually look like when someone is pressuring someone else for sex or, and just the complexities of what actually happens. I think that's often glossed over, and I think that needs to be explicitly addressed. And there's an interesting program that started at the University of Windsor, and it's actually focused on women and girls. So it's gone into high schools now as well. And while there's criticisms of it because it focuses on women as the source to stop sexual violence, the argument that the researcher who designed it makes is we keep trying different approaches on men and nothing seems to work, and this one actually seems to work. But that's a frustrating component in and of itself. But this program actually teaches women about sexual pleasure and what sex should feel like, and that sex should be good, and how to ask for pleasure. And so it pushes back against this narrative that I think is the dominant narrative that sex is for men and men's pleasure, and explains to women that they're supposed to have pleasure too, which is something that's really missed in sex ed in schools. And I think also leads to part of the confusion that if sex is supposed to be for boys and men and their pleasure, and we never teach about girls and women and their pleasure, then we wonder why we get people who think that sex is only for male pleasure and that women's role is to just say no and try to stop the sex.
That's so interesting. Now, so when they say they are having some success with that program, like are they actually able to measure that people who have gone through that program are having less issues, like with sexual assault or harassment?
So they've published a couple studies now based in universities in Ontario showing, and the measure they look at specifically is sexual assault. And they did show that women who had gone through the program were significantly less likely to experience sexual assault in the year after completing the program.
Wow, that is remarkable. Yeah, it does. I guess circling back to even our topic of rape culture, I mean, when we're talking, when you were describing the problem, it's really about all of us and our collective education around consent and what sex is and should be and what our roles, our gender, like each gender or the various genders are in it. So I mean that it is about educating all of us. It's not just a sort of take a wrench and tweak a few things on the male side of things that could fix it. I guess we need to look at it more holistically. So that's so interesting. So I mean, yeah, I guess that the possibilities are there for something similar at Mount A. That's exciting. All right, Dr. Hamilton, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Is there anything else that I should have asked or we should be talking about when we're sort of, just touching the surface of this topic?
I don't think so. I think it is complex, and there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of misunderstandings, and but there are many, many layers of this. So it's not just at the individual layer. It really is this broader systemic cultural thing, which is why we call it rape culture.
Right. Well, I appreciate you, enlightening us about it today. And thank you very much and have a great day.
Thank you very much.
That was psychology professor and sex researcher Lisa Dawn Hamilton speaking with me this past month in Sackville, New Brunswick. If you want to hear more from Lisa Dawn Hamilton, check out her podcast, Do We Know Things, where she explores the things we think we know about sex by delving into the research surrounding common beliefs about sex and relationships. You can catch her every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on CHMA or check out the show online at chmafm.com. That's it for this episode of CHMA Talks. Please join us again next Thursday at 6 p.m. for more conversations with people near and far about stuff that matters.